Hello and welcome back to the Earfuel Podcast. As always, I'm Joel Freemark, and you can follow me on Twitter at GetEarfuel and at The Daily Guru. The podcast is always available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Earfuel and at GetEarfuel.com. This week, I'm going to delve into a few albums that shaped my teenage years. Woohoo! But before that, a quick album review. The album I want to look at today is the brand new one from the XX, and it's called I See You. This is their first new music in about 5 years, and with as fantastic as their self-titled debut was, they're the sort of group that you have to check out whenever they release something new. Now, I wasn't a huge fan of their last album, but I found the lead single for this record to be a step in the right direction, though perhaps it might have been a bit overboard in terms of, I don't know, maybe the super poppy nature of the song. It felt a bit forced, but I liked it. That feeling, that pop feeling, was reinforced at the beginning of this album, as the upbeat rhythm and very clear pop direction is more of a nod to Jamie XX's solo work than it is to the actual roots of this group. And that idea rings true throughout this album, as it almost seems like Jamie wants to go in one direction, but the other two members kinda disagree. It causes these songs to be a bit disorganized or disjointed, and for the most part, this album is forgettable. It's just that these songs sorta spin in place without going anywhere. They're good ideas, but often overstay their welcome, and they don't build to anything of significance. This is a group built on fantastic electronic moods and hooks, and yet they're rarely found anywhere on I See You. To be blunt, you can skip the entire first half of this record. It's one long string of meh and blah. Nothing interesting at all. The songs Performance, Replica, and Brave For You represent the best that this album has to offer, and the vocals and mood are spot on here. It's not that they can't get upbeat, as they've been doing that since day one, but in this album, well, like I said, something just seems out of sync. The single is decent, but it comes too late to save this record. I don't know, it's just another disappointing outing from the XX, and with as good as Jamie's solo record was, maybe it's just time for them to call it a wrap on the group before they spoil the good thing they once had. Bottom line is that I was really let down big time by this record, so I don't see a need to beat that dead horse anymore. Moving on. I'm sure that everyone saw all of those posts across social media where people were basically talking about the 10 albums that shaped their adolescence. It definitely gave me some insight into a number of my friends, for better and for worse, but when I sat down to try and do it, I found it was a bit too vague for me to even make a start at. I mean, if we're talking what most people categorize as ages 12 through 19, I can't even comprehend just how much music I discovered during those years that remains with me to this day, let alone albums that shaped my personality and musical taste from that time period. Are you kidding me? I mean, before I was 12, I'd already stumbled across and formed a love for bands like The Clash, The Stooges, Herbie Hancock, The Rolling Stones, Prince, Metallica, Minor Threat. This list will go on forever, so I'll stop right there. I mean, there was already so much amazing music in my life that it was a bit hard to have this conversation without citing 100 or 200 other bands. But I really did want to try to address that subject, so I narrowed down the rules involved. For this list, I said that the album itself had to be released while I was in those formative years, as it's just impossible to, you know, I don't know, pick 10, let alone pick 50 albums that I discovered over such a long length of time. So the other constraint that I decided to involve was that I only allowed myself one album per year. And, well, that's why Alice in Chains' Dirt record got bumped off the list, because at the very last second, I realized there was another album in play from 1992 that had far more impact on me. So that's the rules. I'm going to give you my five albums that really shaped my adolescence between 12 and 19, and I only allowed myself one album per year. Since I just picked five albums, obviously on the outside looking in are a number of albums I truly adore. They had a large impact on my musical life and taste, and I just wanted to at least say them by name. So in no order, the final six that didn't make the cut, Alice in Chains' Dirt, Digital Underground's Sons of the P record, Guns N' Roses' Use Your Illusion 2, Pearl Jam's 10, Belly's Star, and the Beastie Boys' Check Your Head. All of them are outstanding records that I adore beyond words, but they didn't make the top five. And within the top five, it was actually difficult to figure out the order I wanted to put them in, so I decided to do it chronologically by release date. So we will begin on November 3rd, 1992. Any guesses? It's okay. That's kind of an obscure thing to know release dates, and I actually don't remember the details behind the first time I heard the lead single from this record, but in many ways, I don't think I ever recovered. Even 25 years later, it still demands attention and to be cranked up to maximum volume. The song was an instant anthem that's still shouted to this day, and the entire record kind of stunned the world of music as there was really nothing else like it around. In fact, this is one of those albums that the instant you hear pretty much any riff from the album, you know it. You think I'm kidding? Here's the opening of the first single from the album. That's right, 1992 gave us the self-titled debut from Rage Against the Machine, a band that absolutely nobody could touch, and while it eventually ushered in a movement of terrible imitators, more than 20 years later, this album remains untouchable and far beyond damn near anything else released since. It's a bit metal, it's a bit punk, it's a bit hip-hop. I mean, there's really no single way to define the sound of Rage Against the Machine, and this record hit me really hard, not only because of the pummeling music and lyrics, but it was one of the first instances I experienced where it was obvious that the band did not play by the normal musical rules. Sure, grunge was a bit louder than music happening at the time, but when Rage landed, there was no precedent for that sound, and it was, at least for me, it was an outright musical revelation. Now, at the same time, one of the most impressive elements of the self-titled Rage Against the Machine debut goes completely unnoticed by most listeners, and that's the absolutely perfect production and acoustic balance throughout the album. I mean, these guys, think about it. They are pushing out an incredible amount of volume, and yet the balance between the instruments is perfect. And even after more than two decades, many audiophile publications actually use this album to test the quality and performance of amps and speakers and things like that. Production-wise, this record is incredible. I think one of the other big reasons that this album had such a lasting impact on me was because, like many young people at the time, I was looking for a voice for my frustrations at the world. The Clash and Minor Threat and bands like that were already favorites of mine, but they weren't speaking to the current issues because, well, they'd both long since dissolved. And Rage? Well, they were bringing the truth at every turn, speaking on every issue possible. They also gave me one of my all-time favorite lines in the words, "Your anger is a gift," and, I mean, who doesn't get pumped when you hear this? Come on! Yes, I know my enemies. They're the teachers who taught me to fight me. Compromise. Conformity. Assimilation. Submission. Ignorance. Hypocrisy. Brutality. The elite. All of which are American dreams. Also, as a guitar player, Tom Morello blew my mind, as the sounds he was creating basically turned everything I knew to that point completely on its head. I know I'm not the only teenager of that era who was suddenly looking around my bedroom to see what I could manipulate my guitar strings with to create some unique or just different sound. It was beyond opening a new door. It shattered certain notions about how you played an instrument. As I see it, from the very first moments of the album, Rage Against the Machine's self-titled record presented a brand new brand of musical anarchy, and the group name alone, it told you what you needed to know. Blending all of their sounds into an energy rarely matched by other bands, there wasn't another album that hit me with the same impact, and few records sound as fresh and relevant after more than 20 years than this one. I can't say any more about it. This one was a game changer for me. Now, moving ahead a little under a year, but switching musical directions nearly 180 degrees, I can actually remember the very first time I ever heard anything from Counting Crows. It remains one of the most vivid memories of my youth, and their August and Everything After album remains in regular rotation 23 years later. You feel old? I do. Now, why was that first time so vivid for me? Well, I was at summer camp in way upstate Michigan, and it was the last week before I had to go home. I guess it's story time now. The group of campers in my cabin took a bit of a trip away, and we went inner tubing on some river. I really don't remember much about that part. Anyway, We're driving the hour plus back to camp, and I was sitting in the front of the van with one of the camp counselors, and everyone else in the van was either asleep or well on their way to that. So I'm just kind of chatting with my counselor, and he says, hey, you know, I'm going to put this tape in. Yeah, it was a tape. It was 1993. Give me a break here. And he said that it was the new album from his friend's band, but it wasn't going to be out for a few more months. So he puts in what would become August and Everything After, and I was completely captivated by every second of the tape. Because similarly to Rage Against the Machine, the sound and the feel to these songs were like nothing else being done at the time. Whether it's the wide range of instrumentation, Adam Duritz's voice, or that gray, rainy feeling that emanates from every second, I was instantly hooked on this record. You've got some country going on here, a bit of folk, there's rock, and yet they craft nearly every one of these songs with clear pop sensibilities, and it lends a bit of levity to many of the more downtrodden and pained moments.
I wanna set fire to this city, not in the desert, yeah, we're gonna ride. Time and time again.
The melodies throughout the album are outright incredible, as they help create a vivid, late fall world around you. So many times on this record, you can feel a cold wind or a setting sun or just those smells that permeate the air as fall heads towards winter. I don't know. I've always felt that and never found another record that touches all of my senses in a similar manner. But I digress. Of course, at the center of these songs, you have the fantastic lyrical work of Adam Duritz. The guy can spin metaphors like nobody else in history, and he brings a raw honesty that was beyond refreshing as the last vestiges of the 80s sound were fading. From the loneliness of Sullivan Street, a song where you can kind of hear the fall leaves falling, to the brighter sounds hiding pain like Rain King, to the somewhat haunting Anna Begins, the idea of lyrics as poetry is rarely as obvious as it is on this album. Even all of these years later, you can still find fantastic new turns of phrase and new interpretations of these words, which is one of the many reasons I keep coming back to the record. There are so many lines that I felt a kinship to at different points in my life, and the last four songs in this album represent one of my favorite closing sets in all of music history.
3,500 miles away, but what would change if you could.
But that also helps to highlight one of the most impressive elements of Counting Crows. They're able to sustain that melancholy feeling throughout, but they spin it in so many different musical patterns that it's, you know, it's that diversity in sound that few bands can match. Even while they keep a generally low-key feel to the songs, in terms of the instrumentation and overall sound, it's constantly changing. To me, much of this comes from their use of different organs and accordions, and yet it's often the small guitar touches that really make these songs hit. I don't know. I think August and Everything After is the epitome of an album you have to experience to understand. Sure, people know the big singles, but it's the rest of the album that makes it truly special. Maybe it's because I love cold weather so much, or maybe it's because I'm naturally drawn to pained writers singing of loneliness. But whenever I speak of the music I remember most from my teens, this is one of the first records that comes to mind. Now, hopping in a completely different direction, one year later, September 1994, brought an album that impacted me to a level almost no other can touch, Notorious B.I.G.'s Ready to Die.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, Rap Attack, Mr. Magic, Molly Mall. I let my tape rock till my tape pop. Smoking weed and bamboo, sipping on private stock. Way back when I had the red and black lumberjack with the hat to match.
I've said it before, and I will say it again. Of every MC in the entire history of hip-hop music, the Notorious B.I.G. is hands down my favorite, by miles. The smooth flow, the punches he throws, the laid-back moments, the lyrical flips, just everything. From the first spin, it was clear that this record was gonna be with me forever. That's not to slam records like The Chronic or Doggy Style or other big hip-hop records of the time, because they remain in regular rotation for me. But I was all about the East Coast sound, and nobody tops Biggie. Now remember, this is a record that almost never was because he was working with Puff Daddy, who was unexpectedly fired from his job at Uptown Records, basically nullifying his record deal. In the intervening months before Bad Boy Records was founded, Biggie, real name Christopher Wallace, went back to drug dealing down in North Carolina. No joke. That big separation in recording times and places is why you can hear slight differences in the sound on the record, as they come from two very separate recording sessions, talking nearly a year in between them. And yet they fit perfectly together, though the later sessions do feature a far more confident sound in his voice. Whether it's the gritty feeling on Things Done Changed, the bright sheen on Juicy, the unforgettable single of Big Papa, or the chilling darkness of the album closer, Notorious B.I.G. masters every sound and every style across the record. Like so many rap albums at the time, Ready to Die is filled with tales of the streets, Brooklyn in this case. And it's the way that he paints the harsh realities of his life with the more playful word pairings that's really the magic of his talents. That was kind of the difference for me, Biggie's flow. It was just so effortless, and when he started rhyming on the offbeats and jumping the bar line, I was hooked. On tracks like Warning and Everyday Struggle, you're right there on the corner. You can smell the cars go by, and you can feel the urgency in his needs. And you know what? That's a huge part of it now that I think about it. It's the urgency in his vocals. It's not like he had to shout or speak quickly, but there's this intensity that breeds the urgency, and you can just feel it. He's able to combine the serious with the silly, and each song is a graphic tale unto itself, each one a classic. And let's not forget the iconic track, The What, where he and Method Man create a true hip-hop classic. Yeah, that's on this record too.
I'm not a gentle man, I'm a method man. Baby, accept it, utmost respected.
Assume the position.
Stop, look, and listen. I spit on your grave, then I grab my Charles Dickens.
Welcome
bitch
to my center. Honey's feeling deep in their placenta. Cold as the pole in the winter. Far from the inventor. Well, I got this rap shit sold. And when my Mac unloads, I'm guaranteed another video.
This is also before Puffy decided he wanted to make annoying noises in the background of every song, and it's more raw and gritty than the flashy sounds that you find on his posthumous releases. There are hard-hitting bass lines, thumping musical arrangements, and more hooks than you can handle. It's the ideal balance of an old-school feel with a modern style that still rings fresh today. Classic samples, but with a gruff exterior that, again, it was beyond smooth and just fit. On a larger scale, there's not an MC in modern times that doesn't borrow from Biggie, but on a more personal level, I remember sitting in my bedroom memorizing every word of every song on this album. It's really where I learned about how many ways a vocal could fall within the bar, and this applied to all genres of music. At the end of the day, Ready to Die is my all-time favorite hip-hop album, and you know what? Here is an embarrassing admittal. One of my earliest email addresses was actually a play on a lyric from this album. If that's not influence and impact, I don't know what is. Two more albums here, and we're done. And the last two, I suppose, are somewhat obvious to longtime listeners and maybe to those folks that watch the YouTube channel, because 1995 and 1996 each delivered an album that I still listen to nearly every single week, and both became sort of musical hiding spaces for me in those teenage years. June 13th, 1995 was the release date of Bjork's Post record, and I don't think there's any other album I've gone through more copies of over the years. I've had probably half a dozen copies on CD, four or five copies on vinyl, a few tapes. I mean, I've played this album a lot, and if you could burn through MP3s, the number of total copies would probably be in the high triple digits. Much like the first two records we discussed, the reason I'm so drawn to Bjork's music in general is that it sounds like nothing else. It's brilliantly unique, but Post speaks to me far louder than any of her other musical works. That's not to say I don't love Debut, Homogenic, and others, but there's no competition with Post in my mind. This album pulls together everything from jazz and classical to heavy metal, hip-hop, punk, and swing, all in a whirlwind of electronic hypnotism. Add to that Bjork's unmistakable voice and constant need to push the boundaries of music in every possible direction, and on many levels, the music of Bjork is the very definition of words like original, unique, and undefinable. The The record is a deep exploration of Bjork's thoughts on love and the world at large, but at the same time, there's a very present sense of movement on every song. The energy pulses at every turn, and it quickly envelops you, creating a vivid world of colors and sounds and smells all around. Post runs the sonic gamut from the pounding sounds of the album opener to the almost whimsical It's Oh So Quiet to the mesmerizing Possibly Maybe. But the delicate truth of the final track, Headphones, is one of my favorite moments. This was the album that really opened me up to so many other sounds, whether it was electronica, diving deeper into jazz, or just the overall idea that there was amazing music to be found in every corner of the world. I have to point to Post as the moment that my hunt for sounds far and near began. Or in other words, my obsession with music is somewhat Bjork's fault, but I'm okay with that. Back to the album. Bjork is about as much of an acquired taste as exists in the world of music, as everything from the instrumentation to the orchestrations to the way that the lyrics are organized often goes against the musical norms. But for me, that's much of the fun. The songs flow seamlessly into one another, and yet you never know what tones and feelings are coming next. It can be a completely overwhelming sonic assault where noise is just everywhere, or it can be a gorgeously fragile arrangement where the quietest note has a huge impact. That's where the brilliance is. Bjork understands musical construction in a way nobody else does, and that's much of the reason I keep coming back to this album and all of her catalog. Along with that, Bjork's voice shows what it means for a vocal part to become another musical element. Unlike the majority of music, her voice is an additional instrument, and from more formal vocals to shouts and giggles, that's really the piece that holds this album together. I don't know what else to say here. This is a record that absolutely changed my life. For me, it's really that simple. I do get why some people have a bit of difficulty with Bjork's voice, but to me, it's absolutely perfect. Post will forever have a large place in my heart, and no other album has touched me in the same way, and I think it's because her words and performance are so honest and unguarded that made it possible to burrow so deep into my own mind and heart. Cheesy? Maybe. But it's still very, very true. So, the final of the five albums that forever changed me during my teenage years. It's an album I've spoken about many times, and it's just turning 21 years old this month. Tori Amos's Boys for Pele. When I look back on every album I've ever heard in my decades on this planet, I think it's safe to say that no other record comes within light years of my affinity for this one. I think it's the case of a certain sounding record showing up at a very specific time in my life, and that chance timing both changed and saved my life. As much as I adore getting lost in Bjork's Post, Boys for Pele was a true refuge for me. Those of you who have found safety in music know what I mean by that. This record opened a small door for me, and once I was inside, the rest of the world sort of fell away. Even 20 years later, that still happens for me. I don't want to call this album magical or anything, but it certainly impacts me in a way nothing else does. But let's talk about the music here, as Tori pushes far beyond the girl in a piano thing, incorporating sounds both loud and heavy, but only when they aid in getting to the core of the song's intent. Perfect. Honey, bring it close to your lips, yeah. The distinctive sound of that Bösendorfer gives such a great tone to many of these songs, and it allows the songs to swell in an entirely new manner. The more gothic feel comes into play, and no, I was not a teenage goth. Get that one out of your head right now. I have never and will never shop at Hot Topic, thank you very much. Sorry, as I was saying. There's a gothic feel to many of these songs, and you can feel, I don't know, a bit of a moonless night in New Orleans, maybe that sort of feel a number of times. But there's also something almost a bit sinister going on a number of these songs, especially on the first half of the record. that underlying feeling of menace cannot be denied. There are these tongue-in-cheek, grinning moments that almost seem like asides or inside jokes from Tori to the listener, and it's the way that she spins these moments that become nothing short of captivating.
You see how all your loves, they all cool.
Yet the simple beauty that is the music and talents of Tori Amos is far from forgotten here. Hey Jupiter remains one of the most devastatingly lovely songs in her catalog, and the record gets more and more emotionally raw as it progresses. In fact, the final four songs here, they're just magnificent in the heartbreaking sense of the word. The stillness of Putting the Damage On and Twinkle are second to none, and In the Springtime of His Voodoo remains a personal favorite.
Standing on a corner in Winslow, Arizona, and I'm quite sure I'm in the wrong song. Two girls, 65, I've got a peace town up in the backseat on Hollywood.
These songs weave perfectly into one another, passing the tone of intense, almost bewitching, dark desolation from one to the next. And again, you can't get past the feeling that there is something very, very wrong, even when the music is a bit brighter. That's one of the keys for me, the sense of mystery that sits underneath so many of these songs. There are so many secrets to be discovered, and Tori gives you a complete world for the senses to just fall into and get lost inside. Clocking in at an hour and 10 minutes, Boys for Pele is beyond essential to me. I don't think I would have made it out of my teenage years if this album didn't exist, and as we're still in the dead of winter, it's one of my favorites to spin on moonless nights when it's super cold out. I truly, honestly, love this record, and it continues to shape my life to this day. So there you go, five records that not only shaped my teenage years, but set the stage for my music obsession. During those years, I was exposed to countless records from across the decades that stick with me in current time, and that's why I had to put some sort of restrictions on where the albums came from, or this podcast would have been a few days long. Anyway, hit me up on Twitter at @GetEarFuel and @TheDailyGuru, and let me know what single album most shaped your life. Now, before we wrap the episode, I do, of course, have your weekly EarFuel listening assignment. For everyone new to the podcast, each week I assign an album to listen to in full, beginning to end, without any distractions or interruptions. It stems from the fact that these days, music has become largely relegated to a background task. You're at the gym, you're driving, you're at work, you're whatever. And this assignment is about taking some time each week to consciously listen to music for the sake of the music alone. This week, well, you know what? Go listen to any of the five albums I just spoke about. Grab one that you've never heard of, dig in, and thank me later. So that's all for this week. Be sure to hit me up on Twitter, and as always, the podcast is available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under EarFuel, along with at getearfuel.com. That is your weekly EarFuel. Share and enjoy.